Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Let me say Shana Tova to those of you who are Jews. It's the new year. Today, happy 5783. Yep, this is our year, Jews. Let's make sure we understand and all know as one that they still hate us and that it's subtle. It happens on a lot of levels. Sometimes it's outward. You know who those people are. But sometimes it might be your pal, or it might be somebody you agree with politically. It might be just somebody that you assume is an okay person for the most part. But you know what? There's a little bit of Jew hate in almost everybody. So just stay vigilant, but stay out. Stay out. Don't hide. Don't hide. Jews be Jews. All right? Shana Tova to you. Yom Kippur is around the corner, and maybe we'll get a clean slate. I don't know, but I just wanted to put it out there, Jews. So look, today I have Sigourney Weaver on the show, and she's like actually all over the place right now. She's in the film The Good House with Kevin Kline that opens this week. She's also in the upcoming movie called Jane with Elizabeth Banks about the movement of women providing abortion services for women when abortions were illegal. She's in Paul Schrader's new movie, Master Gardener, which is another exploration of bizarre and troubling moral conflict and masculinity. And that just premiered at the Venice Film Festival. Also a great movie. It's sort of a recent trilogy, I think, of Schrader's movies. Schrader, who I talked to Sam Rockwell about. I would call them a trilogy. I'm looking at his filmography. But it seems that these three, First Reformed, The Card Counter and Master Gardener are of an ilk, but they're always, a lot of them are about men. Difficult, morally dubious men. I'll be in Toronto this week, Friday and Saturday. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour, get tickets for that. Not many tickets left. I want to say thank you to the people of Boulder, Colorado, and to the people of Fort Collins, Colorado. Both those shows sold out. I had no idea. I did the shows with Little Esther. We had a great time. Good shows. Been doing a lot of reading. I've been doing a lot of watching. I've been doing a lot of thinking. All right? All those things happening. I just read David Baddiel's book, Jews Don't Count. And it was provocative. It seems that I'm going to be doing a live WTF with Mr. Baddiel in London. It's at the Bloomsbury Theater on Wednesday, October 19th. I haven't done one of these in years. It's a live WTF, so come out, even if you're coming to my stand-up shows later in the week. And you can get the tickets to that at WTFpod.com/tour. The info is there. But the book was interesting. It was an argument about basically the anti-Semitism, either latent or dismissive anti-Semitism, of the left primarily. And he really dealt with a lot of stuff in there, and I'm still processing it. So I read that, and I've been watching Ken Burns' documentary about America's reaction to the Holocaust. And a lot of times, you know, when people get political, or celebrities get political, or anybody gets political, people think it's some sort of posturing. But the truth is that you learn to understand and engage when you learn to understand and engage. Who the fuck knows when that's going to happen? It's not an organic thing. You have to be concerned. You have to want to be part of a change or elevation of ideas. And then, you know, applying that idea of what do I wake up in service of? I'm a fairly selfish guy, but I'm angry, I'm concerned, and I'm engaged. What do I want to lock into and try to make a difference with or try to focus on? Al Franken once talked to me about it. It's like you have to pick your issue. Like right now, you know, in Iran, it's a disaster. It's a fucking nightmare. It's a theocratic, religious, fascist nightmare. Mahsa Amini, this woman who was detained by morality police, they call them that, and killed, has now like unleashed massive protests around the world and in Iran. Rightfully so. That's what needs to happen. It's what happens. And who knows how it's going to play out. That's a reaction to a very specific religious fascism. That's what it looks like. In an extreme sense, Russia, now we're sitting around waiting for Russia to decide whether or not Putin's ego will absorb failure and not unleash nuclear arms. So now he's mobilized all these reservists who didn't even know they were had to fight again. Hundreds of thousands of people, thousands and thousands of people are bailing. They're jumping ship in protest, in fear against authoritarianism. And in watching this documentary that Ken Burns made, to see how it just starts in any country. Donald Trump is doing rallies and QAnon fanatics are doing some sort of thing with their hands. Anytime things with hands happen, you know what it reflects. Whether or not, you know, Trump's actions at this point are desperate or he's a man in trouble, who the fuck knows? But he is a guy consolidating what is essentially an American fascist base. You know, I think a lot of regular or slightly craven or not completely out of their fucking mind Republicans are starting to be like, I don't know. But he's definitely appealing and focusing on a specifically fascist base, a brain fucked bunch of misinformed, aggrieved people who he's hoping are willing to do whatever the fuck he needs them to do whatever the fuck he wants. Now, there's protest here. There's engagement. But this is all happening. You know, and what am I in service of? I mean, all of us should support any sort of pushback or protest against fascism, which is either functioning in countries or almost functioning or taking hold when you see what's happening in these Republican governed states on school board levels, in which books they're saying can and can't be read, how they're handling LGBTQ rights, how they're handling abortion rights. This shit creeps in. All of a sudden, you know, you live in a state long enough and you realize a generation of kids wasn't allowed to know the history of America in its truth, or was denied or forbidden to engage in educating themselves about different types of people, different preferences. Two generations past that, history gets erased. What's happening now is a pushback against decades of liberal democracy, an attempt to create equality and balance. That was very threatening to people like Samuel Alito coming up as he did. This has been going on for decades. Christian fascism, autocracy, authoritarianism, they're all related. So, women in my life, powerful women in my life, have books out this week, I believe. I know that Betty Gilpin's book, All the Women in My Brain and Other Concerns, is out, and Betty's a genius. Not only is she an amazing actress, but she's very smart, very funny, poetic, cutting, and satirically sound, and raw and truthful, all of it. And these are sort of a collection of essays It's very exciting. You can get the audiobook as well. All the Women in My Brain is available. And Betty Gilpin is one of the best people. I'm excited about it. And she didn't even ask me to promote it. And the other woman who I see regularly, who I've always spoken highly of, who I watch a lot, who I've argued with at times. There's only a couple of comics I've got into it with and remain friends with. And that's Bill Burr and Eliza Schlesinger. We've had words over ideas, and we've come out the other side of those times with a certain mutual respect. Eliza has worked her fucking ass off for a long time. Years. I remember she featured for me in La Jolla once. And now she's a, you know, she's a powerhouse. She does a lot of specials. I think she's got a new special coming out on Netflix, but she has a book. All things aside, absolutely correct opinions, Eliza Schlesinger. And she wrote a nice thing to me. That's all it takes, I guess. Eliza is a force to be reckoned with, as is Betty Gilpin. Both have books out, and I recommend them. All right? No paid promos there. Just peers doing things. You know, I had 23 years sober in August. And, you know, I'm not as regular a meeting goer as I used to. I don't have a home group. No one usually, the last 2 years, I've gotten a coin. And it's not like I carry the coins around with me, but you want a coin and you want a heavy one, especially when the years get up there. You want a nice, heavy coin. Coins are what we get when we get a year, 2 years, 3 years, years. A nice brass or metal. You want a metal coin with the number of years on there. And a few years ago, I remember buying my own because I wanted to have one. But the last couple of years, I've just gotten in my P.O. box a letter with a coin from a woman named Terry. I don't know Terry. I don't know her. It just says, "Hey, Mark Maron, congratulations on 23 years of continuous sobriety. Please accept this coin from me to you with gratitude for everything you do through your work to help the still suffering alcoholic. You educate and inspire by allowing us to watch you walking the walk. So sending love and light to you in service always, Terry, AA Central Office, Little Rock, Arkansas." Thank you for the coin. Again, Terry. And that's the way it works. But I don't know her, and I didn't even know anybody liked me in Arkansas. Also in Denver, I saw my old junior high buddy, Eric Tittman, from way back, and he brought me a kind of great birthday present. Eric Tittman was the guy, he was seventh grade, maybe I was in eighth grade, we used to ride the bus together, and I used to bring a cassette on. He did. He had a cassette that he made and had the Stones. I think it was the first time I heard Sweet Virginia. First time I heard Midnight Rambler was from his dad's records through his cassette on my cassette player. I think that's the way it worked. And we used to listen to that stuff. But I didn't remember. You know, like, we go way back, but we don't see each other hardly at all. But he came to the show with his wife. I think it's his wife. I don't know if they're married. But he brought me a birthday present, and that was David Bowie's Changes One. But get this, it was mine. He's returning my record. It's got my little name on it up in the right-hand corner, Maron. My copy of Changes One from junior high school is now back with me. What a great present. What a great present. With my little writing. That's my Changes One. And that was the record that introduced me to David Bowie. I remember how I found out about that. It was at camp. Okay, let's get on with it. Sigourney Weaver is here on this episode talking to me. You're going to hear it momentarily. The Good House, her movie with Kevin Kline, opens this Friday, September 30th. Here we are, me and Sigourney Weaver. So do you go down to Hawaii a lot?
Oh, we do. He has some family there. And if you've only gone through Hawaii, like on your way to somewhere else or whatever, being with a native who can show you everything, the right, you know, food trucks, right, and the right, yeah, waterfalls, and just the spirit of growing up in such a special place with such a remarkable history,
yeah,
culture, the music,
how does
the dance.
How does his family get there?
Interesting story. His grandfather,
yeah,
was Scottish, and he was in the Black Watch during World War One.
Huh. What is that?
So that's a Scottish brigade of soldiers.
Okay. All right.
And so he was with his platoon.
Yeah.
And they were being shelled. And so he was the only one that had a sweep hand on his watch. So he timed his guys out to safety.
Yeah.
Like 12 of them.
Yeah.
And then for himself, he was the last one.
Yeah.
He forgot to look at his watch. So he was in an explosion, and they had to put a steel plate in his head.
Huh.
And they said, you really can't come home and live here because the extremes of temperature will be so uncomfortable for you. You have to go to a warm climate. So he hitched a ride on some steamer going, yeah, out to Asia. He had an uncle in the Philippines. I think he might have known someone in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And he taught himself accounting, a whole way of dealing with numbers on his way out.
Huh.
And when he got to Honolulu, he thought, well, this looks pretty good to me.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, he sent for this girl he knew a tiny bit from the next town over.
Right.
From Forfar, Scotland.
Yeah.
Who arrived, and he had to marry her as soon as she got off the boat.
Yeah.
And I think she was terrified. I think,
yeah,
she, you know, honestly thought she was
from Scotland,
going to be eaten or,
yeah,
something.
To,
you know,
Hawaii,
that she was in some,
yeah,
dangerous world. And so, anyway, so they had two children, and Jim's dad was one of them. So
wild,
yeah. And then Jim's dad actually was 17 when they bombed Pearl Harbor. He stood on the roof of their house in Kaimuki, you know, watching the planes come, and he signed up. And they took all these boys from Hawaii,
yeah,
and maybe from, you know, California too. Anyone,
yeah,
who'd grown up with anyone Asian, they sent to the European war theater.
As revenge?
No.
Oh.
Because they thought that maybe they wouldn't be able to fight people who they grew up with.
Oh, I see.
So
yeah,
they,
yeah,
sent these guys who'd grown up in Hawaii to, you know, the winters of,
right,
Europe,
yeah,
which they knew nothing about. They knew nothing about the terrain.
So his dad was like on the front, like in the,
yeah,
and wow,
he was in the Navy, but he was in that theater. He was.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's amazing how people, like, where they land and how they kind of evolve and where their families are from. I mean, to be a native Hawaiian is a very unique thing if you're not a native person.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, they call someone born in the islands a Kekioka Aina, a child of the islands. And so for people, white people who've grown up in the islands who make that their home.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they feel Hawaiian, but they definitely feel like their home is Hawaii.
Like, yeah, I would think, I mean, at some point, I think you'd have to feel Hawaiian. I grew up in New Mexico, and, mm-hmm, I feel relatively New Mexican, but I wouldn't say I'm, you,
yeah,
know, native to it.
It's probably more political than that in,
sure,
in Hawaii. I've never actually asked him.
That's probably right, yeah.
You know, because there's still a sovereignty movement there.
Yes.
And, there's still, you know, there's a lot they're still working out.
Yeah, it's. I go down there. I go to Kauai a lot.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, because I don't know. I just started going there years ago, and I vacation there a,
yeah,
lot, and I love it.
Do you ever go to the Allerton Gardens?
In Kauai?
Yeah.
I think I have been once.
Because they have a wonderful dinner tour.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They take you through these amazing garden rooms.
Oh, I don't know. I never did
that. This man, Mr. Allerton, he traveled with a young man that he said was his son.
Uh-huh.
They traveled all over the world. This,
right,
is in the 20s. I think at a certain point they decided enough already, and they went back to Hawaii, found this land, and then they brought people in. So they would have these enormous parties,
huh,
costume parties and things like that. And so the whole place is like these beautiful garden rooms. And then at the end of the tour,
yeah,
you see where Jurassic Park shot here and there. Right. And then at the end of the tour, there's you sit and have dinner on the shore where their little house is.
This is in Kauai?
This is in Kauai. It's like the greatest deal, you know?
I don't know why I've never done that.
Well,
next time,
because I think it's still going on. It's really, you know, they keep the tours, it's just enough for one van, so it's only eight of us.
So you're like a garden person.
I am a garden person.
So doing that Schrader movie was sort of like, although the character's heavy, but the gardens seem familiar.
Which
the new movie, the Master Gardener.
Oh, the Master Gardener. Yeah. Yes, and I've actually done a big mini series in Australia where I play a woman who has a flower farm.
Oh, really?
Everything is coming up flowers. It's very interesting. I came to gardening late because my mother is English, and so gardening was something she really did for herself.
Yeah.
She used to whisper to her roses and things like that.
Oh, really?
And I know that my nieces and I, we used to go, I wish Granny would talk to us instead of the flowers. But I always was around gardens, and I always found them so mysterious. And now that I work with the New York Botanical Garden, I'm on the board.
I live in the city. Yeah.
And the garden is such an extraordinary resource.
Yeah.
For New York. You know, I never went there. I grew up in New York. But now it's just filled with splendid things. It's never looked more beautiful. And you take your family up there. It's free on Saturday and it's free Wednesday morning. And you have 250 acres of, you know, I think it's like 40 acres of old growth forest, for instance, you can wander around, as well as the most beautiful, you know, state of the art, you know, all the trees and all the flowers, the conservatory.
Oh, that's great.
And then, of course, at Christmas, they have the holiday train show, which is in the conservatory. Have you done that?
No.
Oh, my God, you've got to go.
There's a lot of things I have to do, apparently.
Yeah, no, I mean, the holiday train show, it's all built of natural, like, acorns.
Oh, that's
and, you know, it's a whole replica of all the famous things in New York.
Oh, that's
you know,
cool.
Like,
and done in
twigs and
aviary. And would you call it?
It's in the Edith Haupt Conservatory,
okay.
Which is this big, huge, beautiful glass building that was built, I don't know how many years ago.
Wild. I'll have to go to that too. I go to the Huntington Gardens. Have you been there?
Yes, I certainly have. Yeah, I'd like to go there now.
Yeah. It's before it all dries up.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Sad. So, like, I watched all the new movies
that you're in.
Yeah, and I saved that Schrader movie for last.
Uh-huh.
Because I hear he's ill, and it might be his last movie, maybe, sadly.
You know, I think that now that the movie came out in Venice, and he received, you know, certainly deserved the Golden Lion.
Yeah.
I felt that the next day after all of that press, he had just bounced back.
Oh, good.
So I think it's a mistake to think that Schrader's down and out.
I'm a big fan, and the last few movies have been very interesting. The Priest movie and the Card Counter, and this one's very surprising. Now, like, when you out of these three movies that you did, like the new ones, like not Avatar, but Call Jane. And The Good House. But, like, I have to assume that working with Paul would have been, an exciting opportunity.
Well, I'll tell you, I worked on Good House with Kevin Klein. We did that in Nova Scotia in 2019.
Had you worked with him since Dave?
I guess I hadn't, except that, you know, we're both actors in New York, and so we do stuff.
Yeah.
We'd given an award to Ang Lee after Ice Storm and all that stuff, so he got some tribute.
Oh, that's right. So you were in Dave, but you're also you were his wife in Ice Storm.
No,
I was the other one.
But so this is our first, I would say, happier love affair.
Yeah.
It's more romantic. It is the story of a very wry, funny older woman who's kind of being pushed out of her position in the town,
and
her husband's dumped her for a guy and all this stuff. But anyway, it's a great It's a great story about this woman. You know, she addresses the camera. She addresses us. She confides in us.
Sure.
And she's very funny. It was written by Maya Forbes and Wally Bolodarski. She's a realtor, and she's very realistic about life.
Yeah, it's a familiar job, I think, too, for women of a certain age, the realtor thing.
Yeah, well, I think she's done it
forever,
all her life.
Right.
And you know, her kids sent her into rehab because she does like to party. And you know, so at the end of these days, you see her come home after not having a drink, you know, being a total teetotaler, and she sort of, you know, unhooks her bra, lies on the couch, and opens a bottle of Pinot Noir and relaxes.
Serious drinker, though.
She become, you know, I didn't think of her as a serious drinker. I thought of her as a merry drinker.
Yeah.
And I sort of really wanted to show that the joy and solace of drinking, mm-hmm. Within certain boundaries, and that, it does finally get away from her.
Yeah, I thought you must have done a little homework on that one.
I think everyone has that in their family, so I didn't need to do any homework. It's in my cells, but it was really a lovely job to do, to be able to explore that has been a problem in my family from a much more intimate point of view.
Oh, really? You had the heavy drinking?
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, adult children of alcoholics, when you see a bottle, you know, it always seems to have a skull and crossbones on it for you.
Sure, yeah.
And so you can have a drink, but you're so aware. It's like the way people look at the ocean.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You look at it and you know that it has a power that you might not be able to control. So it was really interesting to sort of to investigate that.
Well,
that,
it's interesting because, like, when you are an adult child of an alcoholic, it can go either way. I mean, you either become an alcoholic or you become the hypervigilant kind of, like, you know, try to keep things in control and to manage.
I think you have to be lucky also, maybe genetically, that you don't get the thing that makes it more likely for you to have a drinking problem.
Yeah, bug, I call it.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel blessed that I was able to support my dad, who's the most wonderful man. He loved radio, and so do I. And show, you know, show what's so wonderful about those few drinks and how convivial it makes people.
Sure.
Certainly after COVID, I think we all became more acquainted with the bottle.
Sure.
And then continue to tell the story to where, you know, Hildy has to
she
make
hit
some
bottom.
Decisions.
I mean, she hit a real kind of like hallucinatory. I like the whole sort of witchy element and the hallucination.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and also, like, you know, I'm a recovering guy, and to sort of do that well is, it's important to sort of get that right. And I think it did pretty good job at that.
That's great. I'm so glad to hear it.
Yeah, and also I thought the Call Jane movie, it was another. I just watched a documentary about those women.
Yeah.
On HBO. So did you watch? You watched it?
Yes, I did.
And I thought that was a beautifully written movie. What's her name? Phyllis Nagy? Is it Nagy?
Phyllis Nagy. She wrote Carol.
Yeah,
and,
what a great movie that was.
Yeah, and so she directed this and found the most amazing cast of women.
I thought it was great.
Elizabeth Banks. Well, I think that it's coming out at a good time in October.
Sure.
And, you know, to tell the story of these women who came together to help other women find safe abortions before Roe versus Wade was passed. And they took care of each other.
And they performed abortions.
They did.
I thought Elizabeth Banks was kind of, I think it's the best I've seen her.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful role for her. She's amazing.
You liked working with her?
Oh, I loved working with her. I mean, but she's amazing anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I always think that she completely, you know, elevates anything she's in.
I liked your character too. I thought everybody was great.
Yeah. I loved my character. My character is an old, you know, rye activist who's been around for a long time. And And so I really related to Virginia.
Well, you were sort of coming of age at that time. Do you remember that time?
Of course.
I mean, the late 60s?
Yeah, I was in high school, and then I went off to college. And
where?
I ended up at Stanford, where I did a lot of sort of theater outside the school. But
They had some radical scene there, didn't they, in the late 60s?
Oh, man. I mean, we never had a spring term when I was there because we had the Stanford Research Institute develop NAPOM, had a hand in it. And so we were trying to get things like SRI off campus because we didn't feel they belonged in an institution like ours. And so it was constant upheaval.
Yeah.
I don't think Stanford likes to look back. But and also the war, you know, constant war protests.
Yeah.
It was an amazing time to go to school there. I would say that a number of my professors were communists. And, and you know, it was a very, you know, a very earnest soul-searching time.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of country are we?
Yeah, and, it's happening again.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but I think that no one could have anticipated that a decree would come down from the Supreme Court on high, you know, ripping away these fundamental rights from women. I still cannot believe what they did.
Well, I think it seemed like it was always on the table, which was a big fear. And it was really a part of the motivation that I think the left and Democrats were trying to make people aware of with the Supreme Court when, you know, when Trump in 2016.
Yeah.
That, you know, despite whatever you may think, this is the important thing.
Absolutely. I think that I expected there to be a national dialogue.
Yeah.
That's healthy.
Sure.
Everyone's entitled to their point of view.
Yeah.
But, you know, the you know, pro-abortion, pro-choice people aren't, you know, they're not saying that people who don't believe in abortion should have abortions. And yet they're saying that people who believe in choice and should be made to carry these children to term. And it's
crazy.
It is so
and it's
cruel.
It's right back where that movie sort of takes off, where Call Jane. And I think that you and the cast and the writing really created the sort of horrendous desperation and sort of, you know, what could be very unsafe situations and it just what it would look like.
Yeah.
And also the demand for it. I mean, I don't think people really contextualize that this isn't it's not a willy-nilly kind of decision anyone makes.
No, it's the hardest decision in the world. Nobody wants to have an abortion.
Sure.
You make a decision like that for all kinds of very personal reasons that no one in their right mind would want the government to be interfering with
or to stop it.
Yeah.
Do you remember when it was when Roe was instituted?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. It was 73. And, you know, it was so much was happening for women back then.
Yeah.
And it made perfect sense that this would, you know, this would enable women to have, you know, to be able to make the choices they needed to make, to have families when they chose to, and also work. And we've, you know, when you look at all the progress women have made in the last 50 years, it's so amazing. And no matter what the Supreme Court does, they can't take away those 50 years that we've had where now we're running businesses and we're, you know, doing all these things. So we have to remember how far we've come. And this is just
a horrendous setback.
It's a horrendous setback. And I'm you know, we're going to change it.
Fight.
Yeah.
So but you grew up in New York?
I grew up in New York.
Right, and because I know that you mentioned your father liking radio, but I didn't realize, like, he was like a major, he shifted the entire medium from radio to television, right? I mean, that was his thing.
Yeah. I mean, he started off in San Francisco in radio. He did all the ads, and he also produced the shows and everything.
So he was a broadcaster?
Yeah. You know, he was like right out of college.
Right.
And
okay.
Then he ended up coming to New York. He really believed, until the day he died at 94, that television was our rocket ship around the world and all kinds of different experiences. And if you wanted to watch the opening of the Bolshoi Ballet, That's your right,
yeah,
as an earthling.
Yeah.
And
so he believed it as a great liberator.
Totally.
And the thing that would bring us all together.
Bring us all up together.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. It kind of did, right?
Yeah, until it kind of didn't, I guess. I don't know what you think of some of the shows, but no, he and you know, that's why it's so funny. You have a podcast, but in the old days, we'd say that you had a radio show. And,
sure.
You know, that used to be the heart of America, were all these amazing radio shows. So,
and they were live.
They were live. And
he came up through the ranks as a producer, and then he worked for which, for NBC, or which one did he work
for? I'm not sure he came up through the ranks.
Yeah.
He kind of hopscotched around. He had such a clear vision, and I think he because television was just being developed, he got in NBC when they were just starting out, and he created the Today Show because he said people need to wake up, find out what's happened in the last 12 hours.
That.
He created the Today Show.
It's still on, isn't it?
It sure is. Created the Tonight Show.
Come on.
He produced Show of Shows.
Really?
He created the magazine format. He was the first person to put ballet and opera on television. You know, had Milton Berle come out and introduced a Margot Fonteyn, and she did a big bit of
that
Sleeping Beauty.
That's amazing history.
Yeah.
Did you spend childhood at the NBC building?
I did go over there. J. Fred Muggs kind of mugged me.
Yeah.
He took my hat and I never got it back. I think it was in shreds.
Yeah.
But I must say, I think it certainly influenced me, because I knew that whatever it was my father did, which I don't think I understood, made him very happy.
He
loved what he did. He came home smiling, no matter what.
Well, if you're hanging around
huge crises there were.
You're hanging around Sid Caesar and Milton Berle.
Well, exactly.
And that whole crew. You're going to kind of be chipper.
Amazing people. So I think that that's probably why, even though I was really shy, et cetera, I sort of gravitated toward the business, because I thought the greatest people are in it. And they seem to have so much fun.
Wasn't your uncle in it too?
He was in it, Uncle Doodle, Doodles Weaver. He had his own show.
Yeah. He's like a huge comic actor forever.
Yeah.
Right?
And he also, he was a one man band. Literally, he played all the instruments at once, and he was with Spike Jonze Band forever.
Oh my God!
Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of strange show business in my family, I'm proud
Doodles
to say.
Doodles Weaver.
Yep.
Do you remember him being entertaining when you were a kid?
Yes. Yes. But I also kind of remember the feeling that he was on.
Always.
Which my father used to talk about. And my father used to be a little fascinated by it, because he was surrounded by people who were on.
Right.
And my uncle was usually on when we were with him. So I never had a peaceful moment with Doodle. We never had a quiet philosophical talk, because he was always, doing things that he could then talk about, doing crazy things.
Yeah, but you were able to talk to your dad, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, Dad and I were very, very close. And
what about your mom?
My mother had been a very successful actress in England.
Oh, wow.
And once the war broke out, I think various things happened. She ended up giving up her career more, because his career, was so all-involving. And I think that was a decision she regretted.
Yeah.
Also to as she grew older, Women's Lib, sort of seemed to bring all these opportunities out. And I think she felt, that she had missed these opportunities. And she would have, whatever my mother took on, she would have been amazing in. So I think she felt it was a bit of a waste for her to be a mom and wife. Although, she adored my father, so.
But, do you think she was bitter?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. She didn't sit around and mutter about it, but
right.
But they had an amazing life.
Yeah.
But I think that I think she would have loved to do more work, and I think she was quite astonished that her daughter, who was kind of a dweeb, shy and awkward and clumsy and everything else, managed to somehow become a butterfly in this business and survive.
How did that start? I mean, how did you start? I mean, because, I mean, it looks like you did a lot of theater. I mean, you definitely didn't cut any corners.
I know. I mean, I always really loved theater. Yeah. I always did what I would call sort of illegitimate theater. Uh-huh. So I was never part of the Stanford Theater Department, which did very boring old productions. And so we had our own company. We toured the Bay Area in a covered wagon.
So it was like a kind of a hippie time thing.
Yeah. Except, you know, I think we were pretty good. We did, you know, we did King Lear. We did
On
Hamlet.
The street?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Wherever we could set up.
What was it called?
It was called King Lear. Oh, it was called The Company.
Oh, okay.
And we did new plays.
And this was in San Francisco?
This was in Palo Alto.
Okay.
And so when it came time to graduate, I thought, oh, geez. Ugh.
Yeah.
I don't want to go down and get some nerdy job through my father on a television station. What can I do that I really love?
Yeah.
And I ran around and auditioned for drama schools, and I got in. So I took that step.
Where to? Where'd you go?
I ended up going to Yale, which...
That's a good one.
It is a good one.
Wasn't Klein there, too?
No.
He wasn't?
I can't wait to tell him you said that. he went to Juilliard, and he's very Juilliard proud.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And I always think that Yale was better because we had our own playwriting department.
Oh, okay.
You know, Juilliard was doing the classics.
Yeah.
And we had our own mad playwrights like Chris Durang and Wendy Wasserstein and
funny
Alfred
stuff.
Inarato.
Yeah, yeah.
We did the Yale Cabaret, and we were out of our minds. And
so they gave you a little more freedom, and you could work on new playwrights' works.
Yes, and I loved that more than anything. And in the end, I ended up coming to New York and just doing off Broadway, doing a lot of the work from these guys, and just
like Durang.
Yeah, never got paid, but somehow managed to eke out a living in New York. And
it's such a different time, you know. Everything seemed more, you know, in terms of my perception of it, more vital and more like you were actually, there seemed to be a kind of creative inventiveness that was going on at all levels in the 70s.
I mean, I do think New York still has all of that. It's just that money's kind of ruined it.
Because,
you know, to have an off Broadway theater takes, you know, the fundraisers and the board and all these things that, you know, in the old days you didn't need that.
Well, that's what I think is happening. It's like rock music. It's like you were at the source. So what happens is generations want to recapture that, and eventually it becomes either a mimicking, or it becomes something that gets that sold out a bit. But in the 70s, it was actually, this is new.
Yeah.
Right? You're
Absolutely.
Setting the standard.
Well, I'm not sure we're setting the standard, but we sure as hell had a great time, and I think put on a great show. I was always very proud of the work we did in off Broadway. I think it's super important.
Like what? Like when you got out of Yale, so you did the whole program?
I did. I'm not sure I should have, but I did.
Why?
Well, they weren't very enthusiastic about my work.
No.
No, they were like, they actually said you should leave the school.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the criticism? Because like Juilliard was terrible with that. They would throw people right out.
They would say, look left, look right.
You're
out. One of you won't be here.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I had a class of 18, and at the end of the first year, two left and eight were asked to leave.
Really?
And the rest of us were put on probation. Who knows?
Who was in your class? Anyone we know?
Kate McGregor Stewart. Mm-hmm. She's had a wonderful career. It doesn't surprise me that you know, my class is still working somewhat under wraps.
Yeah.
But I would say any of us who've kept at it, if you can do it, it's. I'm amazed to see some of my colleagues. They're still working in the theater in New York.
Yeah.
And doing the most incredible work, like Reed Burney and people like that I came up with.
Yeah,
Christine Nielsen.
If you're cut out for it, and it's a life you want, and you I think with any of these things, like comedy, which is what I do, or acting, it gets to a point where there is no real plan B. I mean, what are you going to do? you know, teach? Are you going to?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think some people can't hack it and they get into production on some level or writing. Or there's a lot of actors that do other things.
Yeah.
Directing.
I thought, well, you know, they're probably right.
Yeah.
I probably don't have a future, but,
no.
You know, I can run a theater and my friends can work there. I thought,
sure.
I'll get the degree.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually think it was one of the, looking back, it was actually a kind of gift because I came to New York with absolutely no expectations.
Really?
I'd already heard the worst.
Oh, right.
But those teachers were fired when I left. But
you know,
because
were?
Apparently they didn't like actors. Maybe don't hire faculty who don't like actors.
Because they're failed actors?
I don't know. I don't know what they were.
But
one
they really
was a
got...
voice teacher and one was a director.
And they really got fired.
Oh yeah.
Wow, that's sort of justice in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you did get down there to New York, so you just got into off-Broadway, but then you did big plays though eventually, right?
I'm not sure I did big plays.
You were in the original cast of Hurley Burley, but that
well,
was
yes,
years later.
That was, yeah. So that was much later.
Yeah. But like, so you were just kicking around doing young playwright stuff and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, that kept me busy for a long time. I worked at the Public, too. And, you know, we worked in a lot of places where, you know, the show would run about 3 weeks and then the building would be condemned. You
yeah,
know,
yeah, right.
Or the audience would be afraid to come down to that neighborhood in Hell's Kitchen or whatever.
Right.
We certainly didn't have bathrooms. We usually didn't have heat.
What'd your old man think of this, of you doing it?
That's a good question. I think that he thought how great that Sig went to drama school.
Right.
That's something.
Yeah.
I remember, I think he said Doodles wouldn't have had the patience for that.
Uh-huh.
So I think he liked that. I think that he, I think my parents, because they were in the business,
yes,
and knew that it could eat you alive.
Sure.
I think they probably thought I would make a meal for the business,
yeah,
one of those days, but that I had to get it out of my system or something. I don't know. I certainly think there were never two more surprised people than my parents, who every year I'd come in and I'd have another successful movie. And
right.
I think they were just shaking their heads in shock and dismay. And
but proud, I imagine.
I think they were proud, but I
yeah.
think it was mostly shock because they know what a you know, hard and sometimes rotten business it can be.
But wait, but like, was it that surprising? Were you that much of a sort of like quiet kid, a nerdy kid?
I wasn't like, quiet.
Yeah.
I wasn't quiet, but I was this tall when I was 11.
Okay.
So I was very, and I was very insecure. So it did, you know, it took me a long time to grow into myself.
Yeah.
And I think that whatever success I had in the business, which came quite late, you know, I did Alien when I was 28.
Oh, wow.
It took me a long time. I mean, I felt like I was still in the oven for a long time.
Sure.
Finally, I remember one birthday, I went, you know, I think I'm done. I'll take myself out of the oven now.
I'm full.
And just, I'll be toast.
I'm cooked.
Yeah.
Well, did your dad do little TV bits here and there? Did he still have the power to help you out in that
way? I did not want his help, Mark.
Okay, all right. Just for a little walk-on.
No, I actually was offered a very good role in television when I was still at the Public playing a maid who
yeah.
cleaned the glacier in a John Guare play.
John Guare, I know that guy, yeah.
Marco Polo sings a solo.
Yeah.
It was probably my first paying job, and I was offered a very nice, big role on a
uh-huh.
TV series that was very high profile. And I turned it down.
Really?
Because I thought, I really don't want to do the same thing.
Over
in case
over,
it's
like,
a hit, which
right.
it looked like it would be,
right.
I don't want to do the same thing for 5 years. I'll go nuts.
Right.
I'd much rather be the maid cleaning this great glacier with Joel Grey and Madeline Kahn.
Yeah.
I really was, maybe because I hadn't had as many opportunities coming up as, you know, training.
Yeah.
I wanted to eat all the theater I could. I was just ravenous. And I certainly didn't want to have a job that had too much sameness.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I'm young. You know, I don't need that kind of security. I'm going
right.
to continue in my odd world doing my odd thing.
Right.
And
it paid off.
Well, I mean, all you can do is follow your heart at the time.
Oh, my God. I was so confused. I didn't know what my heart was. I just knew what I didn't want to do.
Well, that's what it was. I knew I didn't want to go yeah. to L.A. and sure. have the security of a show that would continue year after year.
Well, you had that foresight to know what the job is, and I think that probably comes somewhat from your upbringing.
I think so, too.
You know, because a lot of people who don't have any understanding of the business would be like they take anything.
Oh, absolutely. And if I'd had parents who didn't know the business, I might have felt I have to take this job
right.
so they stop worrying about me and they see that I'm decent enough actor so I can get work. But my parents weren't like that. And
right.
And so I was able, you know, with their support for a while to you know, continue following my heart.
Yeah. I mean, because you would definitely have been familiar with the repetition of television, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a whole career, and I imagine even your uncle on some level represented a thing that stayed the same for decades.
Yes, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
Although I bet he had lots of different colors in
sure,
there.
Sure, yeah.
Know?
but he's a comic actor, and
yeah.
I mean, he did. But
yes, he's in The Birds.
Yeah,
we watch it once a year. We go, there he is. There's Uncle Doodle. He's so good driving that boat.
Well, I mean, so what was the first movie?
Well, the first movie was Annie Hall. I was in a show with Chris Durang that he'd written. I had written a curtain raiser with him called Das Lusitania Songspiel.
Yeah.
That made fun of everything on Broadway and used all of, you know, claimed that Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht had done all the current songs.
Oh,
and,
okay. So it's a comedy.
It was a comedy. It was
satire.
A cabaret.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was offered a nice role in Annie Hall, a much bigger role. And I turned that down because I could not. I was playing a multiple schizophrenic in Chris's play, Titanic. I
yeah.
played this little girl in a sailor suit who had a hedgehog in her vagina, and she fed it at the table. Then I morphed into this woman, Helena, who was a multiple schizophrenic.
Yeah.
And then I morphed again. Anyway, I was irreplaceable at this point because I had so many different personalities
sure.
in the show.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, you know, if Woody Allen would offer me a nice role, you know, now maybe he'll offer me a nice role again someday.
So you turned down a bigger role to take which role? Which I'm trying to remember.
I ended up getting a walk-on at the end of Annie Hall. I'm with Walter Bernstein, and he's with Diane Keaton at the very end.
Oh, right, yes. Oh, that's right.
In front of the theater.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Sorrow and the Pity. So that was my little consolation prize
right.
from Woody Allen. And So that
was another, like, you chose theater.
You
didn't want to
theater.
Let your friend down. Really.
Yeah, and I think I would have let myself down, too, because I had, as I said, I'd co-authored it,
yeah.
and we had such an amazing time.
Well, that's like, those are like, you know, I mean, it sort of makes sense in looking at the roles that you did choose and what you're known for, that you would have this fortitude to just say no, you know what I mean, to honor yourself and to honor your friends and your responsibility to things.
That's making me sound very honorable, but I think I just had to follow my nose
yeah.
where I found value, and I think I also loved what I was doing. I didn't really want to go into another dimension, which was like Woody Allen, that's a serious, like, that's a film, that's
yeah.
different from what I do. I wanted to stay in my little.
Do you think any of it was fear?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it was fear.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about a film career, except with great skepticism, because to me, I think my father was in TV. I thought film must be even crazier.
Yeah.
And more unpredictable.
So what shifted for you? How did Alien come to
well,
be?
Well, and then I think I had...
Because it was pretty soon after that.
Yeah. I had gone out, I think, the next year maybe,
uh-huh.
and met some casting people.
In L.A.?
I finally had gotten an agent.
Okay.
Which took me years because people would go, oh, she's really good in that. She's so tall. And I couldn't figure out what to do with her.
Really? The tall thing was really a problem.
Oh, yeah. Because I was like almost 6 feet. And they were like, oh, you know, she could never play anything,
and all the,
really.
All the men are like 5 feet.
Yeah. And they sit down as soon as you come in the room. So anyway, I went out and met some good casting people.
Yeah.
And then I think when Ridley Scott was sent to New York to interview actors for this movie, I was on the short list for reasons I don't know, and I wasn't very interested.
Yeah,
you know, science fiction, which I knew very
was it always
about.
Written as a woman's part?
Actually, the original script, it was 10 men, and Walter Hill and David Giler, who ended up writing the script, thought, well, listen, it's 10 little Indians. We'll just make the girl the survivor because no one in their wildest dreams will think it's going to end up being the girl.
Right.
They thought it's going to end up being John Hurt's character, who's so brave, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so they really did it just for story reasons, you know, even though they love strong women. And
there was one other woman too, right? And
the
crew,
Lambert.
Yeah.
And that was a very funny part, actually, is originally written. And you know, it was a very small cast, and I don't think Fox wanted me. You know, I was unknown.
Yeah,
I think there were people with names trying to get this part.
Yeah,
I just got really lucky that the producers and Ridley. You know, I met Ridley. I was wearing these huge hooker boots that made me too tall to even be in this room with you, Mark. You know, I don't know what kind of thing I looked like when I walked in. But anyway, we had a great talk about the script that I was pretty critical of. I said, it's pretty bleak. I don't know about this love scene. Would you really get it on while this thing was running? Anyway, we had a good talk.
why this monster's eating people.
I know. And I ended up doing a screen test with Ridley in London and got the part. I mean, I was so incredibly lucky. And then once I got the part, I thought, well, now I better do a good job. You know, I thought, here I am. I'm going to be in this new medium. I remember thinking, oh, don't worry about it. Just pretend you're doing off-Broadway.
Right. Did you think that?
Yeah, I did that all the time because I thought, it's not a really legitimate movie. It's like a little dark movie over here. So I'm still in my world.
Right.
So I get to still play in this playground.
And I guess nobody was, I mean, Ridley was not a huge director yet, right?
His second movie.
Yeah. So I guess there was no reason to think that it wasn't just a little dark, weird movie.
Yeah. And what's wrong with a little dark, weird movie?
And what a cast, though. I mean, to work with Harry Dean and Yaphet Kotto and all those people are great.
Absolutely.
Ian Holm? Jeez.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
So, but it seems to me that whatever anyone was judging your craft or how everyone was looking at your acting, that you sort of dug in and were very emotionally available and you know, interesting and vulnerable in that part as Ripley. I mean, it was a fully deep performance.
Oh, that's great. Well, yeah, I remember thinking, I'm not going to be able to play Henry V, but this is my breeches part. So I can imbue this character with anything you might see in any leader anywhere. And I had a very interesting discussion with Ian Holm, actually, because I remember he became my good friend, which I needed then because I was very lonely. I was over in England by myself.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to him, do you think that Ripley knows what she's doing? Do you think that she thinks she's right all these times? And he said, yes, I think she does know she's right. And I said, I don't think she does. I think it's a total crapshoot and she knows it. And she's just got to fly by the seat of her pants, hoping.
Confidently.
Hoping. No, with confidence.
Yeah.
Because I think that that's the story. It's a kind of everyman story. It's about someone who's, you know, who thinks that the trip is going to go this way, and she has a sort of manual of how things should go. You know, she's a young ensign, and she has to give up all of that order and And to me, it's everyone's story.
Yeah.
And especially for a woman, because she's not going to whimper in a corner and say, I need help, because she's got to do it herself, which I think is what, that's why I am an actor, I think. I think that's what women do.
Yeah.
We do the tough stuff all the time, and I love telling that story.
Well, it seems that the way you engaged with it was contextualizing it as an every person's story, but it was a woman's story, and the weight of that. But I guess you couldn't have had any idea the impact it would have on show business, on women, on women in show business.
I'm still amazed by it.
I mean, it was like a pivotal and game-changing movie.
Yeah.
That a woman could carry a movie like that.
And I think of Ridley Scott and how innovative his camera work was. He and Derek Van Lint, who was our DP, they just huddled together every minute, coming up with how to hold the camera and all these things that no one had ever tried before.
Yeah.
So it was an experience going to the theater.
And that monster.
I mean, that monster. And that was all Ridley, too. Yeah. He found amazing
Geiger.
Art student.
Is that Geiger?
He found Geiger.
Yeah.
And so we were using Giger's designs.
Yeah.
And he found an art student at a local pub who was 7 feet tall from Africa. He put him in the suit.
Yeah.
So the wow. man was so gorgeous. He already looked like he was from a different planet.
Wow.
And then he put on the suit.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to do with how good the script was.
Yeah.
How wonderful the cast was that Ridley assembled. And the camera work. The sound, all of those things scare the shit out of people, and people have enjoyed that ever since.
I didn't realize that he had found Giger. Giger wasn't established at that point.
No, I don't think so.
Because he became sort of a thing.
Yeah,
Giger
totally.
Art.
Yeah.
And then that monster comes back for all the movies, like in some version, right?
Yeah.
So now, like, looking at that, looking at Ripley, do you find that character evolves?
Oh, completely. Completely.
For you too, in age, and then it's sort of, well, obviously you're like, I know what's up. With Paul Reiser, like his weird villain turn.
Oh, yeah.
That was great.
That was great.
With you.
And I think that again, Jim Cameron, it was
different
his
director.
Idea to to write the story based on Ripley's coming back into the world and trying to warn people. So he gave the Ripley character in Aliens the most incredible arc, from this sort of anti-hero kind of thing. And and so I think that really solidified the kind of reputation of what this movie was. And
how was the transition from Ridley Scott to Cameron? How did that, I can't remember, I know I was told, I think Walter Hill must have told me something, but how did that happen?
I think that Walter and David were talking to Jim Cameron about something else.
Yeah.
I think Jim had just done like Piranha 2. And I think he had the Terminator, bubbling away.
Yeah.
But I think they kind of, in those days, no one did a sequel.
Right.
It was like very,
oh, really? Is that true?
Yeah, no,
uh-huh.
It was considered very, not cool.
Right.
But I think somehow Jim mentioned that he'd love to write a sequel for Alien.
Yeah.
And they thought, hey, why not give that a try?
Right.
I don't think anyone expected it to be this tour de force.
It's great. It's a great movie.
It really is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, by that time, it was, I don't know, several years later, I've been really lucky to work with so many different strong directors.
The Year of Living Dangerously, was a great movie. I remember seeing that movie.
Yeah, Peter Weir.
Yeah.
I learned so much from him.
Like what?
Well, I think that he said the first day, he said, gosh, I didn't realize how inexperienced you were.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I guess that's true. I think I'd made two movies.
Yeah.
He said, so you just, just when you're talking to Mel Gibson, just talk to him. Just be Sigourney talking to Mel. You don't need to do anything else. And on some level, I got it. I trust his eye.
Right, but that's also that weird, tricky transition from theater in a way.
Oh, completely. That you do too much, or
just the talk. Like, I can't not, like, if I'm on a stage of any kind as an actor, I'm like, what's going on? You know, like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's like you're mic'd. We have a boom.
And you have to adjust, or do you? I mean, that's the great question: is that if you have it inside of you, does it change from theater to movies? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
Well, I would think just the tenor is all I think I'm thinking of. Like in theater, you do have to project a bit.
You have to project a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely.
But not on a set.
No.
Yeah. So, well, Weird was great. And then Freakin', you did that weird Freakin' movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that. I talked to him. He's an intense character.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So, moving into, like, you did many movies with Cameron, like these relationships with Scott and Cameron, like, were career long,
mm-hmm.
and then Ivan Reitman as well.
Yeah,
and that was really you can do comedy.
That's what the school ended up saying. Said, you know, you're great at comedy. Don't
that's
do
what
anything
Yale said?
Else. Yeah, and that's really what I am good at. I've you gotten think? Away with the other stuff.
Really, you think that's true?
Oh, without a question.
Huh. And Ghostbusters was a blast, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And these are movies that made people's childhoods. You know, between Aliens and Ghostbusters, it's like, you know, you must have people coming up to you of all ages just saying, like, oh my God.
Well, it is fun. I never quite know which movie they're going to mention.
Right. And Working Girl was a huge movie, too.
It was a huge movie. And Gorillas in the Mist.
Oh, yeah. My God.
An amazing adventure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why, as you know, you're an actor, the business is so incredible because you get to learn all these different things, go to all these places.
If you're willing to go for 6 months and do a thing.
Oh, yeah. You got to.
How many real gorillas did you work with?
I worked with Diane's study group 5.
Yeah.
So there were about 25 gorillas in that group. And I went up every day or every other day with Simon Trevor, the great wildlife photographer, and one other guy who pulled focus. And we just spent the entire time with them.
Yeah.
And tried to keep our heads down and be very respectful.
Uh-huh.
And we had a lot of great surprises and got some really good footage.
Yeah. So how many Avatar movies did you just shoot? 9?
So we have shot, we had made one a long time ago.
Yeah.
That's being re-released, remastered this month.
Oh, so they're going to re-release the first one?
Yeah, they're re-releasing it sometime this month.
Yeah.
And then Avatar 2 is opening December 16th. Then we've already shot 3 that will come out 2 years later.
Did you shoot them down in Long Beach?
We shot the performance capture in Manhattan Beach.
In Manhattan. Oh, that's where his
kingdom is.
Yes. Because I went down there. I met with him.
Oh, yeah?
To audition for the part that the Flight of the Conchords guy got.
Oh, yeah.
But I had no idea I was really going to do an audition that day.
Well, there are more. There's 4 and 5. Get ready.
I think I'm out of the. I'm out of the
I wouldn't be too sure.
But I mean, it was interesting meeting him.
Yeah.
You know, to sit there with him, and he was very nice. But like, what did you have to learn how to do? What did you like? How much time
for Avatar?
Yeah.
Well, Avatar, we learned how to free dive. So we were trained for. We learned everything.
Free dive. That means with no tanks.
Yeah. So we had to do. I play a kid in Avatar 2 because my character died in Avatar 1.
Right.
So the kids, we did a lot of parkour. We did all these things to try to figure out how we are going to move through the forest like Na'vi children. And so we did a lot of physical training. And then because a good bit, like 70% of the movie is underwater or in water, we were taught by Kirk Crack, who teaches the Navy SEALs how to free dive. He taught all of us for over a year how to breathe up and how to free dive. So by the time we were actually shooting in the tank underwater and we had long scenes underwater, we had the training to pull that off.
How long can you be underwater?
Well, I can do a static breath hold, the the most I ever did was 6.5 minutes.
Come on.
I know, it's ridiculous. I can't believe it either, but I'm not lying.
That's crazy.
I know. I had the training and I was using enhanced oxygen.
What does that mean?
So in other words, we're breathing 30% oxygen.
Yeah.
And so sometimes doing the show, we would have 50% oxygen and sometimes we would have 80% oxygen.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I was breathing that day. I'm sure it was at least 50.
Yeah.
But we a static breath hold, you're not moving and you just have to keep your mind from making you panic and make you breathe, because it's a reflex and you can talk yourself out of it for a while.
I'm starting to have a hard time breathing now.
I know. I can't believe I did it for that long. And my husband, who was taking the training with me, being from Hawaii, you know, yeah. He loved all this stuff. He had the same breath hold, 6.5 minutes.
Oh, you just brought
minutes.
Him in because he wanted to learn?
Well, I think that they knew I'd be more secure with him, because he's such a, you know, he's such a water guy.
Yeah.
And I would have to say that all of us facing this and knowing what Jim would want us to do, it was intimidating. So you wanted to train up in a situation where you felt as relaxed as possible. And being in the water with Jim is a very relaxing experience, because he's
your
so
husband.
Knowledgeable. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But Cameron is, you know, intimidating.
Cameron is intimidating is the wrong word.
Yeah.
You don't want to say, no, boss, yeah. I don't think I want anything. You're not going to say anything like that to Jim Cameron. He will tease you so mercilessly until you say, I forget it. I'm going to do it. Just show me where to go and what to do.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of, you know, once he sort of, you know, tagged you to come along and be in his band of merry pranksters, you kind of feel like you're in for it. Whatever
right.
it is, you're ready, you're going to make it work. And I have to say, we watched 13 minutes of it at D23 this past weekend, the Disney whatever. And the stuff underwater was so crazy good that my standing there watching it with the audience, I think my feet started to move as if I needed to tread water, because we were underwater for so long. It looked that real.
Oh,
and it's one of the most breathtakingly beautiful things you'll ever see.
Really?
Yeah. It's totally cool.
So it's gonna pay off.
Yeah, and now I know how to free dive. Not that I do it all the time.
Well, you go to Hawaii, you could do it.
I'm much more confident in the ocean in Hawaii than I used to be.
So after all these movies and everything else, I mean, are there, like, do you, like, you talk a little bit about Weir, you know, kind of like being on to you and showing you something. Did you find that throughout your career, that you were able to pick up stuff from all these directors?
You know, what I found was that the directors are hoping you know what you're doing.
That's right. That's what Walter Hill said, because I always thought, because the idea that a director directs is not about teaching an actor how to do anything.
No.
They
cast you because they think you've got it in you,
yeah.
and then it's up to you to just come through.
Right.
Walter's still a very good friend of mine. And, so I think he's so eloquent about the business and everything else.
It's great.
But no, I think that, you know, Mike Nichols used to say casting is 90%. And I think that's really true. I think if anything, as an actor, you become a bit director proof.
Yeah.
You're going to arrive. You're going to have done your work.
Right.
You're going to have, you know, whatever they call you, pack your suitcase filled with this and that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And you're ready for anything. And I mean, to me, that's where the fun starts. That's where I finally started to get confidence, was when I kind of gave up trying to figure it out and I just fling myself out into the void and see what happens.
Sure. And you're there with other people. You're there with the other actors. Like Nichols, was he special to work with?
Incredibly special. He could come up with the one physical move or something that would explain your entire character.
Oh, yeah.
And he just was brilliant at that. And, you know, because I had this relationship with Bill Hurt's character and Hurley Burley, and Bill's character would drone on and on and on about this and that. And finally, and I said to my, geez, I'm just sitting here kind of putting on makeup, not really listening. And he said, just put your finger down your throat and gag. And so I did that. And the whole audience was feeling that, of course, too. We all wanted him to shut up. And so he was always, he was really, first of all, he totally believed
he directed
that.
He directed Hurley Burley on stage?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the first time I worked with Mike.
And then he directed the movie. He directed Working Girl.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he did. Like, that's so funny, William Hurt droning on.
Oh, yeah. That's what the play is, mostly.
Well, that's great memories. Are you going to, did you write a book yet?
No. I
Maybe you're not going to.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I remember a lot of things, but.
Oh, yeah.
The things I remember are very, to me, interesting, but
not necessarily.
It's fun to talk about it.
Sure.
All.
Yeah. And I want to talk about Schrader for a second.
Yeah.
Because he's sort of a fascinating character to me. And there's the movies he's written and the movies he's directed, but it seems like the last, several movies of his are very controlled and they're very specific, and he seems to, deal with, men, very specifically, kind of like, damaged or struggling or morally dubious, men.
Mm-hmm.
But also the women characters that he seems to be generating are pretty tough and strong as well.
Yeah.
Especially in the card counter too.
Mm-hmm.
So what's it like working with him with that language of his and him as a director?
Yeah.
And what brought you to that movie?
Well, interestingly, we only finished that movie in March.
Yeah.
So for him to have edited it and show it at Venice, as we just did, was really, an act of a Superman.
Yeah.
So he, I met him about a year ago. He had this script, which I thought was impeccable.
Yeah.
I'm used to working with all kinds of scripts, and there was something about this script that was so elegantly written. It was so precise. There was so much that wasn't said.
Right.
There was no exposition.
Yeah.
There are no transitions.
Uh-huh.
It's just this like vertically built, this thing with all these layers underneath that you can never get enough of.
Yeah.
And the part for me, the part of Norma was like a kind of part I've avoided all my life because I think they were often written in a very cliched way, the rich, haughty woman or something.
Okay, right.
And but I thought, you know what? I think this is the one, because I also thought I've never been offered a part like this. She's so out there.
Yeah.
And so I met him about a year ago, and he said, "I want to shoot it in February. We're going to shoot it in 20 days. We're going to shoot it without any money." Joel Edgerton is playing the part, and he was looking for and ended up being Quintessa Swindell, who's wonderful. As Maya.
Yeah.
And, in February in Louisiana, there were not many flowers.
Yeah.
But it is a wonderful story. As you say, it's the lonely man in the room, and him coming to terms with his life.
A heinous past.
Yeah, a heinous past.
And you being the sort of savior, but also somewhat exploitive. But that dynamic, I never seen anything like it, really.
Good. But, I'm so glad to hear it.
But like when you approach a role like that, like, let's just go over the last few years. So like when you see The Good House, do you think like, this is not going to be a heavy lift?
No, I never think that.
You ever never think of it?
Never think that.
You don't judge
the roles. God, I've never done this before. I can't wait to do this.
Oh, good.
I loved Hildy so much, and it was the best part I'd been offered in a long time.
Yeah.
And then
I'm just saying that in comparison to the darkness of.
Well, you can only we did Good House in 2019.
That was wild.
So you had COVID in between.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I did Call Jane. So this I just did. I mean, I feel like I just came home from that.
Right. Right.
And
so every role is just sort of like you're kind of like okay. You're nervous or you're excited.
I'm terrified.
Yeah.
I think, ugh, this is the one. This is the one where
the
I'm going to fall flat on my face. But I also can't think of anything I love more than getting out there, than pushing off into the unknown and letting the character out.
Oh, that's great.
And Norma was especially like, you know, she was Pandora's box once she opened her mouth, you know. Yeah,
and I just, and that, you know, the turn at the end, you know, and then again, just sort of like the relationship shifting. It's kind of an astounding thing. I've never seen anything like it.
I'm so glad.
Have you?
No, I mean, I haven't. I mean, I think Paul's amazing. I feel so fortunate to have been able to work with him, and that he, you know, I once made the mistake of saying, why'd you think of me for Norma? I don't know what I expected him to say.
Yeah.
But I remember that Pauline Kael had been a great champion of mine early on, and he'd knew her quite well.
Yeah.
He said, no, I wanted Glenn Close, but she wasn't available. So, lesson is, never ask those questions.
Oh, now you got that in your head. How would Glenn do it?
Oh, no, I never thought about
that. You never think that?
No, 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 because she didn't get to do it.
Oh, that's good. That's better.
You know, I got to do it. That's the fate rolled the dice, and it's my part, and I never look back.
Like, I don't do a lot of acting, but I did a part in a movie that's coming out soon. And the guy, they told me who they were kind of wanted it to be. And I'm like, oh my God, why didn't you just use that guy?
Yeah.
I'm not that guy. You know?
I wonder why they said that to you, because that's not very helpful.
It wasn't around, it wasn't the director.
Yeah.
It's just something that came back around from who the fuck knows where.
It's just there to screw you up.
Yeah, but eventually, I think what you realize, and again, I'm not much of an actor, but you can only do what you do.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's going to be your version of whatever it is, you know.
So you're just full steam ahead, huh?
Full steam ahead. Having the time of my life, you know.
You ever feel like doing theater again?
Well, not lately. I have to say, I've been kind of working nonstop.
Yeah, it seems like it.
And I have another couple of projects lined up, and I'm working with people I really like. And so there's something about the form of film that probably started with Peter Weir, because that's when I got it.
Yeah.
I got that film had its own weird philosophy.
Yeah.
That, you know, it was perfect that it was out of chronology. All these things that I've been resisting as a theater person, it all kind of made sense in this bizarre way.
Yeah.
And I've so embraced that.
Yeah.
That now to me, it's the more interesting medium.
Sure. You can look at it from a lot of different vantage points, and you can understand the collaboration of it. It's totally different than theater.
Yeah, it's so much about collaboration.
Yeah.
And the crew and the cast.
Yeah.
You know, we're almost all one.
Yeah.
It's
I imagine on Avatar he's like practically living with these people.
Oh yeah. I mean really true.
Yeah.
Because it takes forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's like years. Well, it was great talking to you.
Great talking to you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing it.
My pleasure.
There you go. Cultural icon, Sigourney Weaver. The Good House opens on Friday, and you can see her shortly in Call Jane, Master Gardener, and Avatar, The Way of Water. All right, hang out for 1 second, people. Hang out! Listen, we've got some movie stuff for the next 2 weeks of Full Marin bonus content. This week, we'll be talking about documentaries in advance of my episode with Abigail Disney this Thursday. And next week, we're going to do a full talk about one of my favorite movies, Michael Clayton. I'll explain more of that on Thursday as well. If you don't have a Full Marin subscription, click on the link in the show description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. You dig? This week, I'm in Toronto, Ontario at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre on September 30th and October 1st. Next week, I'm in Livermore, California at the Bankhead Theatre on October 6th and Carmel by the Sea, California at the Sunset Center on October 7th. That's going to be an intimate group in a large room. What can I tell you, man? Small market, Carmel, I don't know. People aren't coming out, but I'm going to do the fucking show. Not really my choice even. It's not a great feeling to play for 100 people in a room for 700, but so be it. It'll get me strong. And again, I want to mention I added a show in London to my London, England dates. I'll be doing a live WTF at the Bloomsbury Theatre on Wednesday, October 19th. My guest will be comedian David Baddiel. Then I've got stand-up shows at the Bloomsbury on Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd. Those probably are close to selling out. Dublin, Ireland, I'm at Vicker Street on Wednesday, October 26th. Then in November and December, I'm in Oklahoma City, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Long Beach, California, Eugene, Oregon, Bend, Oregon, Asheville, North Carolina, Nashville, Tennessee, and finally, my HBO special taping is at Town Hall in New York City on Thursday, December 8th. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. Okay? Anyway, here's some guitar. Monkey and La Fonda, Cat Angels Everywhere.